Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from June 24, 2017. This Saturday's talk and Sangha discussion is the second of seven talks on the Satipatthana Sutta, the Sutta on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
Today's talk is the second of four or five, who knows, maybe six talks on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. The Buddha taught the Four Foundations of Mindfulness throughout his career and in different settings, but primarily in the sutta called the
Satipatthana Sutta.
And in this sutta, he teaches the importance of mindfulness as mindfulness relates to the Dhamma. And the reason why I say that is mindfulness is kind of the new religion of the world today. Everybody wants to be mindful, and it's a good thing to be mindful of what you're doing. But the Buddha taught mindfulness in a very specific application, and it begins with being mindful of the breath in the body, the first foundation of mindfulness. And we talked about this last week, but just to go over it again. In meditation, the Buddha first taught mindfulness as it relates to meditation, and then to take it off our cushion and apply it to different areas of our life. So primarily, we begin our meditation practice with being mindful of the breath in the body. That's the beginning of the establishment of mindfulness. It's the beginning of using the breath in the body to deepen concentration. And as concentration increases, then we're able to hold in mind. Mindfulness means to recollect or to hold in mind. As concentration increases, we're able to hold in mind the other principles that are most important towards awakening, as the Buddha describes awakening. So mindfulness of the breath in the body is the initial foundation of mindfulness. In the sutta, and as I continued this morning, you'll see that now the Buddha is teaching, once we've established mindfulness of the breath in the body, we've established that initial point of concentration using the breath in the body. Now he goes on to address other distractions from being mindful of the breath in the body. And so he treats these distractions as either something that we can use to increase our concentration or at least to be mindful that they're distracting us. And so again, what we'll probably talk about today, depending on how long-winded I get, is feelings and thoughts arising in meditation. And then we'll get into where the Buddha teaches how to apply this off our cushion. So the Buddha's words on the second foundation of mindfulness, being mindful of feelings. And how does one remain mindful of feelings in and of themselves? Even that line gives a clue to what the Buddha's talking about. Don't attach anything else to feelings. In and of themselves, they're just feelings. Finding a secluded spot, the shade of a tree or an empty hut. Sitting erect with legs crossed in front, placing attention on the breath. Again, he's reminding us that we're doing this during meditation. When feeling pain, be mindful that there is pain. He's not saying do anything else with it. Don't figure out where it came from, who caused it, where the injury was, what was the scenario. Be mindful that there's pain in the body, period. He's teaching us directly during meditation to stop joining with things such as pain in this sense. Rather than what is often taught, I'm not saying this isn't useful because there's other applications that are outside of meditation where examining pain is useful, but not in this case. And what I'm talking about is teachings that tell you to embrace your pain or breathe into your pain. That's not part of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And again, I'm not saying that that's not useful, but if you're using a practice like that in some way, make it separate from your meditation practice. So your meditation practice remains primarily for deepening concentration. When feeling pleasure, be mindful there is pleasure. Again, don't start craving for more of what's making you feel good or think good. Don't create further identities by continuing attachment to it. Just recognize there's a pleasant feeling. You're sitting in meditation. You're starting to become well concentrated. Your body relaxes. You notice that that's a pleasant feeling. That's great. Notice it. But don't attach yourself to it. Don't insist that your meditation sessions now always include that feeling of relaxed pleasure. It's impermanent. Remember last week we talked about how the Buddha related all of this practice to impermanence, to noticing the arising and the passing away of everything. And we do that first by becoming mindful of the sensation of breathing in our bodies. Be mindful of the arising. We're taking an in-breath. and the passing away and exhale. That is a direct metaphor for our entire life. Everything in life is impermanent, and if we attach ourselves to it, we're creating a scenario for stress to arise. But in meditation, that first foundation of mindfulness reminds us that all things arise and all things pass away. And so if we become stressed off our cushion, be mindful of the breath and be mindful of the arising and the passing away of all things, including what might be a stressful situation. And remember, stress can be something that we have an aversion to. We hope we don't have any more of this or that we get more of it. Or it could be something that of great elation, great joy, that's creating a disturbance in our mind, and we're attaching to that as a condition of our life. That I need more of this. I always use chocolate cake. Boy, this cake is great. I need two or three of them in my cupboard to be happy. Those are all disturbances in the mind. Let me continue with the Buddha's words. When feeling neither pleasure nor pain, ambivalence, be mindful that there is neither pleasure nor pain. It's really being distracted by ambivalence, by not having something that has our attention or is exciting us in this moment, that we miss most of our lives. And then the rest of our lives is being stuck in the past or the future, chasing what gives us pleasure or what we hope to avoid. We don't want ambivalence. The most of the millionaires of the last 20 years became rich because they realized how much we abhor ambivalence. We need to always be tweeting or Facebooking or all the other things. That's where a lot of that money came from, is because they provided a perfect vehicle for distraction. And again, don't take that too far. There's some good that comes out of all of those things. But basically, when we're using them to create distraction, we become compulsive or addicted to them. They're just further distraction. It's a distraction in the mind, a disturbance in the mind. When feeling the pain of the body, be mindful that there is pain of the body. When feeling pain not of the body, meaning a disturbance of the mind, it might be getting caught up into how the awful things that do happen in the world. The Buddha's not saying don't concern yourself, but recognize it as a disturbance and that we can join to that. And that furthers a distraction. When feeling pain not of the body, be mindful that there is pain not of the body. Just simply recognize rather than join with it that my mind is disturbed. We hear things nearly every day now that are just awful. But we can recognize the brutality that is common in the world without having the next judgment about who to blame for it, where it comes from. Because remember, if we understand the Dhamma, we recognize that all of that comes from ignorance of Four Noble Truths. We don't have to speculate and we don't have to put blame on it. We understand even the most brutal people in the world today are acting out of ignorance. We understand that. And if we can really understand it and act from that point of view, then we can really change the world without creating more upset, more violence in the world. Excuse the slightly political bent there, and we'll go back to it. When feeling pleasure in the body, be mindful that there is pleasure in the body. There's pleasure in the body. I'm enjoying this. Is it getting a little hot in here? I keep trying to turn this on. Michael, how come it's not going on? There it goes. I didn't turn it down far enough, I think. When feeling pleasure in the body, be mindful there is pleasure in the body. When feeling pleasure not in the body, be mindful that there is pleasure not in the body. What's an example of that? I always think of rainbows, of pleasures not in the body. I love rainbows, especially some magnificent ones that I've seen. It's a pleasure that's not in the body, but I think you've heard this story about. I was in Hawaii one time, a few times. Has anybody heard of the green flash? Some of you have. There's this phenomena that happens when you're closer to the equator. When the sun sets, because it sets so quickly, I think, occasionally you'll see this magnificent emerald green flash across the horizon just before the sun sets. And it's really magnificent. And so I had heard about this, and I want to see it, and I'm determined to see this green flash. And day after day, I'm sitting on this little beach in Hawaii waiting for it, and it never happens. And one day it did. And it was really remarkable. And I'm not one to give into physical expressions, but I got up and I'm dancing on the beach, and this is magnificent. The next day, there I am back on the same beach, waiting and waiting and waiting, and the sunset, and it was just magnificent. Any sunset in Hawaii is magnificent. And the sunset, it goes down, no green flash, and I was terribly disappointed. I'm sitting on one of the most beautiful places in the world, watching this incredible sunset, and I was disappointed because it wasn't more special than it was. that's an example of that, of clinging to some a disturbance that's out of the body. You know, it was an external occurrence that I had so joined to, and I was dragging yesterday's with me through that whole day, and I was disappointed from this beautiful sunset. That's an example. The Buddha's teaching things that are entirely practical. There's nothing analytical about it. There's nothing speculative about it. We can apply these directly into our lives moment by moment. When feeling neither pleasure nor pain in the body, be mindful that there is neither pleasure nor pain in the body. Rather than needing the ambivalence of the moment to be different, to be exciting, be at peace with the peace that you have in this moment. Nothing's occurring. That's pretty good. When there is neither pleasure nor pain in the body, when feeling neither pleasure or pain not in the body, be mindful that there is neither pleasure nor pain not in the body. That's kind of a convoluted way of saying, be mindful of what's occurring. Be in your body, going back to the first foundation of mindfulness, the breath in the body. It's bringing us here into what's occurring in our life right now. And what's occurring in our life right now, no matter what it is enough. It's the need for life to be different than it is, usually more or less than what's occurring, that distracts us from our life, that creates stress in our lives. Again, these are entirely practical teachings. Beginning with mindfulness of the breath in the body, now the Buddha's taking us from that well-concentrated point to saying, notice if feelings in the body can be a distraction, or we can use them as a point of focus. Excuse me. In this way, one remains mindful of feelings and the arising and the passing away of feelings. Pointing to the arising and the passing away of all things. If we can recognize that this feeling that I'm having in my body, especially if it's a feeling of joyful attachment, something wonderful has happened and I want more, or a feeling of extreme aversion, something's terrible has happened, I've had an argument or someone said something that's got me upset, recognize that that is impermanent. It has arisen and it will pass away. And it will pass away much more quickly if we cease needing it to be any different than it is. We don't get stuck into the future or the past. We're able to remain mindfully present. The essence of the refined mindfulness that the Buddha teaches is to be mindful of your life as your life occurs, without the need for it to be any different, including yourself. Let me go back that one sentence. In this way, one remains mindful of feelings and the arising and passing away of feelings, independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. Remember how the Buddha describes dukkha. Dukkha is a result of the five clinging aggregates, this personal experience of suffering, joining with the world. We become one with our external events. This is how one remains mindful of feelings in and of themselves. Simply to be mindful of it, without the need for feelings to be any different. That's the second foundation of mindfulness. In the article, I have a couple of paragraphs that I basically say what I just said. There's one point that I wanted to make. One of the things that we can get into, and some other schools teach it, is when things arise in our body, to get into a deep analysis of where that's come from, where it is in the body. I have a pain in my knee, to breathe into that pain, or to trace the pain or the sensation throughout your body. Again, those are all wholesome practices. And if they're useful for you, please continue. But do them separate from a meditation practice. Remember, your meditation practice as part of the Eightfold Path is for deepening concentration. And these other practices, even as a Buddhist teaching here, can prove a distraction from creating a deeper level of concentration. I'm going to leave it there. This is part of the article. Notice that, in my words, not the Buddha's words, notice that it is often a reaction to an external event that was perceived through one or more of the six senses that initiated the feeling. It is at the point of contact with the external experience that a personal self-referential attachment is made. So over the last 3 weeks or so, on Tuesday night, we're talking about the practice of restraint. And it is at that point of contact with the physical world. The six sense bases are five physical senses moderated or informed by the present level of our consciousness. So it's at that point of contact with the world that feelings arise. Something occurs. And so it's at that point of contact that we can practice restraint, to recognize that we're continuing the distraction of the feeling or the thought, or we're continuing developing mindfulness by not being distracted by it, going back to that first foundation of mindfulness. Is that clear? Okay. So now I want to get on to mindfulness of the thoughts, the first foundation of mindfulness. And these are very closely related. Sometimes they're in our minds, they're inseparable. And the progression in the sutta is not all that significant, meaning that it's not just feelings that drive thoughts. Sometimes a thought arises and it creates a feeling, an emotional disturbance in our mind. Sometimes even a physical experience. We might remember, have a thought of something that happened, got kicked in the back, and we'll have a pain in the back. So again, it's not a linear progression. And sometimes we can't separate the two. The Buddha's words. And how does one remain mindful of thoughts in and of themselves? Again, he reminds us that primarily that's developed in meditation. Finding a secluded spot, the shade of a tree or an empty hut. Sitting erect with legs crossed in front, placing attention on the breath. This is how we start developing an understanding of our own thought process, by deepening our concentration first. When thoughts are passionate, be mindful that thoughts are passionate. Remember the third sutta the Buddha ever gave, the fire discourse, where he teaches a group of fire worshippers, using that metaphor, that it is our passions that create all the disturbance in our minds. Be mindful that there's a passion has arisen, that we're passionate about something. Passion is another word for deeply joining with something. And that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be engaged in our lives. But if that engagement with whatever it is creating a passion, a disturbance in our minds, we are joined with it. We're creating an identity with it. And it can only lead to stress, no matter how apparently useful or altruistic it might be. When thoughts are passionate, be mindful that thoughts are passionate. When thoughts are dispassionate, be mindful that thoughts are dispassionate. So what does that relate to? It relates to our own developing Dhamma practice. We might now notice that something has arisen that would have caused a disturbance in my mind, and it doesn't. And we could start patting ourselves on the back a little too much for that. That's a natural occurrence of an awakened human being. There's nothing all that special about it, except it's something that we've achieved in meditation and a fully engaged Dhamma practice. Simply be mindful that I've achieved a level of dispassion. It's good, but it's nothing to attach to. Why? Because if we're attached to it, and we remember the arising and the passing away of all things, this will too, and it will simply create more stress. Be mindful that in this present moment, I am fully dispassionate. That's wonderful. And remember the ongoing process of arising and passing away of all things. Something may occur and likely will occur in the next moment to make you passionate about something again, to take away that dispassion. Just be mindful of what's occurring. When there are thoughts of aversion, be mindful that there are thoughts of aversion. When there are thoughts that are free of aversion, be mindful that there are thoughts free of aversion. Again, the Buddha is not talking about being analytically focused on each thought that arises, but when we notice that the present quality of my mind is now free of aversion, simply notice it and take another breath. When thoughts are deluded, be mindful that thoughts are deluded. So if we're deluded, how do we know that our thoughts are deluded? This is something that the Buddha considered after his awakening. How can I teach, again using these words, the deluded masses that they're deluded? How can you frame something that will pierce that delusion? Another word for delusion is ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The reason why the Buddha taught an eightfold path is to pierce the veil of delusion or ignorance. When we can frame things, again, this is pointing directly to the proper application of mindfulness as it relates to the entire path, the eightfold path and the Four Noble Truths. If we can hold in mind the framework of the eightfold path, then we can recognize the results of our deluded thinking. And if we can recognize the results of our deluded thinking, we can then let go of those. Let go of that ignorant thinking. Most people, when they come to Dhamma practice and are incorporating it correctly, will first notice their deluded or their ignorant thinking and resulting behavior through right speech or right action, sometimes right livelihood, but usually right speech. Because it's such a simple and direct way of recognizing where I'm acting in an ignorant way, where I'm continuing to promote an ego self rather than recognizing the stress that that promotion would bring. In other words, right speech is to remain harmless in your speech, to refrain from lying, to refrain from gossip, to refrain from hurtful speech, to refrain from speech that is unnecessary or not likely to have a useful result. The best example of that is gossip, because I think we've all engaged in gossip at some point. Anytime we're engaged in gossip, it's because we're trying to minimize other people in some way and raise ourselves above them. It's obviously an example of ego promotion, isn't it? And many people recognize it at that point. Or if you're prone to exaggeration, you might notice it at that point. And again, this isn't something that's as much moral as it is practical. When we can look at it in that way, through the moral or ethical aspects of the Eightfold Path, we recognize where we're creating stress in our lives. We're becoming mindful. We're using the aspects of concentration supporting mindful, holding in mind these aspects to see where we're continuing to create stress in our lives. Is that clear? I'm kind of going around in a little circle there. But the point is, how do we get through deluded thinking? The Eightfold Path. When thoughts are free of delusion, be mindful that thoughts are free of delusion. Again, an incredibly practical teaching that a human being taught 2,600 years ago. In its simplicity, it can easily be overlooked. It's important to recognize that the Eightfold Path is delivering what it's supposed to be delivering. Yes, in this moment, and it might just be for a brief moment, I don't seem to have a deluded thought. I seem to be seeing reality clearly. That's incredible, and it should be recognized. The Buddha consistently said, "Ehepasiko, come and see for yourself," meaning you have to see for yourself. Because I don't know if it was Lorna or it might have been Liz Tuesday night, was talking about how once they started noticing, I think it was Liz after the retreat, once she started recognizing the benefit that the Dhamma practice had, it simply reinvigorated her practice to a level that was never there before. There's a word called upekka, which is joy, which means a lot of different variations on it, but joyful engagement. We're joyfully engaged in this because we realize the benefits of it. We found something that really works and can really change our lives. And by extension, it can change the lives of those around us. I'll continue. I'll never get through this part of it. The Buddha continues. When the mind is constricted, be mindful that the mind is constricted. The Buddha describes first in the Nagara Sutta how he recognized that his mind was constricted, meaning it was attached to the world. It was confined or constricted by all these joinings that he had made with the world, creating an ego personality. And primarily he relates that his constricted mind to being a participant in the world when he was a prince in his father's kingdom. He described that life. Now think about this. He grew up as wealthy as he could possibly be, had everything he ever wanted. And upon his awakening, he referred to that as a constricting place. It wasn't something that he looked at as, I really gave up something of value. It was a constricting place. So the outside world is a constricting place, but our minds that aren't well concentrated or well framed by the Eightfold Path is a constricting space. When the mind is constricted, be mindful that the mind is constricted. When thoughts are scattered, be mindful that thoughts are scattered. It's not an awful thing to sit down in meditation and having some difficulty concentrating. Just be mindful of it. Again, remember, this is instruction primarily in meditation. Many, many people give up meditation, especially early on, but even later, because they feel like my mind is just too scattered. I can't control this monkey mind. The Buddha is giving clear instruction. Just notice that it's occurring. It's common. And come back to the sensation of breathing. And 5 minutes later, you may have just been caught in a 5-minute train of thought. What do you do with it then? Come back to the sensation of breathing. When the mind is spacious, be mindful that the mind is spacious. Notice the developing concentration. When thoughts are common, be mindful that thoughts are common. When thoughts are unsurpassed, be mindful that those thoughts are unsurpassed. In other words, don't get caught up in developing mind states that might seem incredibly mystical or incredibly wonderful or incredibly unsurpassed. be mindful of it. Come back to the sensation of breathing. There's nothing to be gained by any of that type of recognition or attachment during meditation. It can only be a distraction. I could tell you, I can go on and on. I could go on and on about experiences that I've had in meditation that were literally incredible. But they were also incredible distractions. Because when I didn't have the right framework, I kept chasing those. And there's a lot of kind of subliminal suggestions at times in creating these mind states. Meditation is for deepening concentration. No matter what occurs, come back to the sensation of breathing. That's mindfulness that's part of the four foundations of mindfulness. When the mind is not concentrated, be mindful that the mind is not concentrated. When the mind is concentrated, be mindful that the mind is concentrated. When the mind is not released, what does that mean? The Buddha describes an awakened human being as someone who is released or unbound from clinging. So it's important in meditation to recognize during meditation, my mind is not released. There's still some clinging aspects. I'm still experiencing the five clinging aggregates. When the mind is not released, be mindful that the mind is not released. When the mind is released, be mindful that the mind is released. So that's pointing to the temporary nature of developing an awakened mind. Because in the present moment, we may not be clinging to something. But unless we have fully developed the Eightfold Path, the next moment will probably bring an aspect of clinging mind. Just notice it. Don't be distracted by it. Don't be disappointed by it. In this way, one remains mindful of thoughts and the arising and passing away of thoughts. There's that reference again to impermanence. The arising and the passing away of thoughts. Anatta, which the Buddha describes as the not-self-characteristic, not something any more than that, meaning that the views that we hold are not a self. Anatta insists on establishing itself in every thought, word, and idea that occurs until we're awakened. What that means is that every thought that we have, unless it's framed properly, unless it's well concentrated, is a self-referential thought. What do we do with it? Recognize that even at that point, it's an impermanent situation. And notice the arising and the passing away of impermanent thoughts. And when we can do that, we're starting to gain an understanding of the importance of understanding impermanence. Everything that arises will pass away. Remember what Kandana said when he awakened. All conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. He was pointing to everything in the physical world, but also, most profoundly, to his own views of himself. And it was at that point that the Buddha said, you are now Anakandana. You are an awakened one. You understand impermanence at such a profound level. That's what this is pointing to, the arising and the passing away of all things. In the four foundations of mindfulness, we begin with the breath and the body, noticing the arising and the passing away of our breath. And that's enough. That's enough of a foundation to build the foundation that the Buddha teaches in the rest of the four foundations of mindfulness. Because at that point, now that we're well concentrated, a feeling arises. And I notice it, but I also notice the impermanence of it, and I'm not distracted by it. I come back to the sensation of breathing. Or a thought may arise, and that thought may have been driven by a feeling. I immediately recognize that that thought is impermanent, and I come back to the sensation of breathing. I recognize the arising and the passing away of thoughts. Now, next week we're going to get into the fourth foundation of mindfulness, where the Buddha describes the quality of mind that results from either being distracted by feelings and thoughts or by not and remaining at peace with a less than peaceful mind state or being at peace with what's occurring. That last instruction I give it, the last 5 minutes of meditation, I think I'm going to confuse it a little bit today. The last thing I say before we come out of meditation is to be at peace with a less than peaceful mind state. That's what I'm referring to is that fourth foundation, mindfulness. If we can maintain our well-concentrated mind, no matter what's occurring in the moment, it could be an agitated feeling or an agitated thought, the fourth foundation of mindfulness teaches us to be mindful of that and simply be at peace with less than peaceful mind state. And I'll talk more about that next week. And then either next week or 2 weeks from now, I'll get into how the Buddha teaches to apply these, the foundations of mindfulness off our cushion to the hindrances that arise, to the five clinging aggregates specifically, to these seven factors of an awakened mind, and finally, how to apply mindfulness to the Four Noble Truths themselves. And it really is in this teaching that we're giving it in the Paticca-Samuppada Sutta that the Buddha teaches the entire application of mindfulness as it relates to the Buddhist teaching. So that's the end of the talk today. Thank you. Any questions related to the talk, and then we'll go around the room? Yes, Becky.
So all of the precepts of mindfulness that we've been studying the last couple of weeks are really meant to sort of happen on our cushions.
Primarily, yes.
Primarily.
Yep.
Okay.
You can say that our
meditation... these are like lessons that we can learn on our cushions.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. And that sort of should be learning, or we will learn on our cushions if we have the right mindset.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. And you qualified that perfectly, if we have the right mindset. Again, if we're going into meditation to have experiences or to develop visions or anything else, which is okay if you want to do it outside of this, because that's not what this meditation is for. This meditation, the Buddha taught meditation for deepening concentration. And it's in that concentration that we're able to support the mindfulness of the whole entire path. What he's teaching directly here is to acknowledge that, yes, feelings can arise and they can be a distraction to meditation. Simply recognize it, come back to the sensation of breathing. Thoughts may arise. They can be a distraction to meditation. Come back to the sensation of breathing. Or if we're utilizing the four foundations properly initially in meditation, then we can notice that a thought has distracted me in this moment. Come back to the sensation of breathing. Without the need to analyze it or judge yourself or the practice, then that feeling or that thought is an additional point of concentration. If we're not allowing it to be a distraction, then it's a non-distraction. It's an opportunity to deepen concentration. It's such an incredibly simple but profound, such a profound practice. The reason why this is called the foundations, and I can't remember the Pali word now. Obviously, foundation is translated from the Pali. Everything is founded on this type of mindfulness. Again, not a general type of mindfulness. And I was going to say there's nothing wrong with general mindfulness. There can be, and maybe I should talk or clarify that. It is mindfulness of the practice itself that delivers the practice. It's not mindfulness in it. So let me qualify that what I just said, general mindfulness. There's aspects of mindfulness that are hurtful. Mindfulness means to hold in mind or to recollect, and we can do that with anything. We can be mindful of anything. So I always relate it back to my past history. There was a time when the only thing I could be mindful of was the next drink. I was an active alcoholic. That's an aspect of mindfulness. I spend every day of my life thinking, you know, no matter what was occurring, where's the next drink coming from? That was It was well concentrated on one word, Smirnoff. Yeah. That was my... I'm laughing about it, but you know, I buried a lot of good friends from that type of mindfulness. It almost killed me a few times, too. That's an extreme example, but a good example of mindfulness. We do that with all kinds of things. We can do it even with a distracting so-called spiritual practice. Be mindful of something that's not helpful. I went on plenty of retreats, and I always get myself in trouble when I go here. A common kind of exercise to teach mindfulness is to do something that you would normally do, but do it with mindfulness, such as eating a grape very slowly and taste it. That's wonderful. And it does teach you to be mindful of eating a grape in a very slow and aggravating way. But it does teach that type of mindfulness, but it doesn't teach mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. And there's other applications of that that are common. Again, I don't want to. It sounds like I'm disparaging other teachers, and I don't mean to do that, so I won't go there. The point is to be mindful of what's occurring during meditation as the foundation of mindfulness. That's how the Buddha taught this. And again, he prefaced this by saying, "Go find the root of a tree or an empty hut, sit cross-legged, etc., and be mindful of your breath." Then he says, "Do the same thing. Be mindful that feelings are arising. Be mindful that thoughts are arising." Don't let them distract you. Come back to the sensation of breathing. And then next week, we'll get to that, how that process properly applied results in a quality of mind that is always at peace with what's occurring. Notice I didn't say a quality of mind that is always at peace. It's a quality of mind that is always at peace with what's occurring. Because to say that you'll develop a quality of mind that is always at peace takes away from the first noble truth, doesn't it? No matter how awakened we are, dukkha is going to occur. But we can remain at peace with a less than peaceful mind state. That's what equanimity, one of the seven qualities of an awakened mind is equanimity, the ultimate quality of an awakened mind. Equanimity means always balanced, non-reactive. But it doesn't imply that there's nothing occurring in the world that might have previously upset you. An awakened human being would notice some of the horrible things that happen in the world. It's not a detached mind. It's a mind that is fully involved, fully mindful of what's occurring. And so there's recognition of hurtfulness in the world. But you no longer react in a self-referential way. You're not enraged by it. By the way, we don't need rage to solve the problems of the world. In fact, we'd be better off if we got rid of the rage and just acted mindfully. Well, again, I don't want to get into a political debate, but thank you for the question. Any other questions related to the talk, and then we'll go around?
Can you just shut up the answer?
Yes. Thank you, Mary.
Maybe everyone else is
being polite. Thank you for your directness. The Buddha would appreciate that, too. Jen, good to see you this morning.
Oh, it's good to see you.
Mm-hmm. This was very helpful today. Came at a really good time. Because I definitely feel that I've been, distracted and have like a lot of aversion and a kind of a constant state of, in terms of the fourth foundation of mindfulness, just like, nope. When you said deluded, If you are having deluded thinking, how do you know that you're having deluded thinking? My answer to that is, if I'm uncomfortable, constantly worried or very, agitated, that's how I know.
Yep.
And it's so counterintuitive to my own conditioned thinking to not think about why I feel that way.
Counterintuitive to your own conditioned thinking. That's a self-referential thought. Remember the Nagara Sutta, you get caught up in that feedback loop of the reaction and my conditioned thinking. How do you get out of it? The Nagara Sutta is a sutta where the Buddha describes his own awakening and struggling with just that point. Yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt
you. No, thank you for interrupting. Now, because I could see it enough to know that I was just, okay, I'm just, this entire story has to just be dropped, even though that seemed so difficult, and just kind of get back to some maybe physical things, whatever it is, what it is for me, but just to kind of get out of my head and let go of those thoughts. That has to happen for me before I can hear this teaching. That has to kind of slow down before I can really take it in. Because otherwise it just gets glommed right back onto some other kind of feedback loop, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And that is, so this came at a good time, because now I feel like I can see it.
Wow. Thank you for that. Think about how the Buddha's teaching this too. He recognizes that when we're caught up in it,
right,
we can't just get out of it. We need something. Come back to the sensation of breathing.
Right.
He gave us a way, a direct way, of getting out of that feedback loop. While you were talking, I was thinking of another great exercise that we can use is Qigong. Matt, Laura's husband, Matt, teaches Qigong and Tai Chi here on Tuesday evenings before our class. And that is one of the most effective body-based practices that complement what we're doing, because it immediately brings us in to what's occurring in our body in a very profound and direct way. And so the only reason I'm saying that is you can you know, maybe come to a class and learn a couple of the techniques, but to use this. If you find that you're really stuck, use some of those exercises and then come to your cushion. And you'll see that immediately you start recognizing that feedback loop and you can get out of it.
And I think the other thing that I wanted to say was that when, and I'm assuming this might happen for other people, but when I'm in the feedback loop, I'm chasing the insight to why I'm this way.
Yeah.
Why I'm feeling, I'm looking for that insight. And I know that that's not going to help. I'm never going to find it because that's a thicket of views or whatever.
Yep.
I feel like there was a teaching on that. Mm-hmm. Something about like searching in your own mind for the answer. You know, it's not going to be there. The insight's going to come after, way after you come back to your sensation of breathing. You just get back in and let go of all that.
The true insight is the insight into I'm feeling this way because I'm ignorant of Four Noble Truths.
Yep.
The Buddha awakened to dependent origination. I'll get into it, but states from ignorance, from an initial ignorance of Four Noble Truths, all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering arises. And again, you don't have to understand the whole dependent origination to just understand that's what the Buddha, that's what everything points to is developing the Four Noble Truths. That's the Buddha's first teaching, and it's everything he taught for the next 45 years of his teaching career was taught in the context of Four Noble Truths. Why? To gain insight into ignorance. And once we recognize the cause of our ignorance and our confusion and deluded thinking, we'll simply let it go. There's nothing else to do. You can't analyze ignorance. What is there to, well, you're analyzing something that is ignorant. All you can do is recognize that it's present and do something to alleviate it. The Eightfold Path. Thank you. Becky, good morning.
Good morning. Well, this was a very good meditation for me. I was not in a really good place when I came in. And I kind of realized while I was meditating what I really know now when I'm in right view and when I'm not. And it's very hard to get there when I'm not there, especially at home, because it takes like a half an hour of meditation. And I really felt like now I'm wondering if I should just not. Sometimes I think I have a point to my meditation, and I shouldn't have a point. I should just sit down, meditate, and concentrate on my breath and see what happens.
Yep.
Instead of working toward this, you know, wanting when I'm finished for myself to feel like I have let go of so much. I feel like I've let go of so much by meditating, but is that leading to true concentration or heightened concentration?
Setting any of those parameters or expectations on your meditation takes away from developing concentration.
Right. Okay.
So a well-concentrated mind is naturally relaxed. A non-distracted mind is naturally free of disturbance or free of a lot of disturbance. So the result that you're looking for is best achieved by simply being using meditation to deepen concentration. So if someone asked you 6 months ago, I think you've been coming maybe a little bit longer than that. So how's your right view?
Yeah.
You wouldn't have any understanding of it. So you've developed a profound understanding. You have to notice when you're not settled in right view, and that's important.
No, definitely.
And you've developed that.
I can notice that for sure.
Yeah, rather quickly.
Very
even using meditation for a physical or emotional / mental result is very, very common, and it's hard not to, you know, to not at least have that expectation. So developing the understanding that maybe I shouldn't have this expectation is also part of right view. Meditation is for deepening concentration. And if we remember that, we'll never be disappointed with a meditation session, because every time that we recognize we're caught up in a thought or a feeling and come back to the sensation of breathing, we're deepening our concentration. Take even that, the Buddha talks about in these four foundations, it all should be taken with a dispassion. This is what's occurring. So, thank you. Good point. Stefan, good to see you this morning. How are things?
Good. I've been enjoying my practice, and it's been nice to have a period of, you know, feeling good about it and enjoying meditation. You were saying something about the Buddha describing a constricted mind, and that resonated a little bit for me. I don't know. Lately I've been thinking that the quality of a grasping mind feels like both figurative and in some sense literal, like the way my mind feels when I'm trying to hold on to a goal or a whatever, kind of feels like the way you would physically grip something. It has that sort of feeling of constriction, like I'm tightening around something, you know, tightening around something that I want to get to somehow. So that noticing that quality of mind has been part of how I kind of become aware of clinging in the mind, you know. So whatever that's for. But
it's worth a lot. I mean, that's such an important... The Buddha refers to that constricted mind often through so many suttas. Recognizing that it's a grasping mind, it's something that we have attached to, and if there's a feel to it, isn't it? You can recognize when your mind is constricted. So many people talk about meditation as developing spaciousness, and it really, you're creating space between thoughts, between those things that are constricting you. It feels, your mind feels more spacious.
Yes, that's a good word for how it feels to me, and I think lately it's also been important for me to kind of admit out loud that it's more important for me to go through the day with the experience of not creating suffering, with the experience of contentedness or calm abiding, you know, rather than whatever ordinary world goal I might be grasping onto.
Yeah.
You know, like those goals seem important, but I have to remind myself that I would rather, you know, go through my life calm and satisfied and poised than achieve whatever thing it is that my mind is gripped to.
Yeah, and then it doesn't mean you won't achieve those things.
Right.
It just means you won't be joined to them. You won't be attached to them.
Right.
And you can much more enjoy the process, too. Yeah. Again, entirely practical teaching, so thank you for bringing that up.
Thank you.
Michael, if you have to go, what do you have to say for yourself this morning? It's good to see you.
I didn't know you were a mind reader.
I know you're busy, and it is getting... I want to give you an opportunity.
I'm attached to an appointment I have shortly, so I was going to raise my hand after Laura shared, just to say, if I may, share.
Please.
And then go. It's just so wonderful to hear everybody and share the exact same thoughts, struggles, feelings, distractions that I have, that we all have. You know, we're all so much more alike than we are different, regardless of how we perceive it. So it's wonderful. I've noticed that adding the second meditation a day, adding the morning meditation to my late afternoon one, makes a huge difference.
Doesn't
it's
it?
Almost like there's a rhythm now.
Yep.
And I do have glimpses of a non-attached mind, recognition of impermanence, but 99% of the time I don't. But it's okay, because I get it. It's the journey.
Yeah.
It's just really being mindful.
Yeah.
It's so simple, so beautiful, and I'm so grateful to do it in collective, because I do notice, not today so much, but In the past, when I meditate with a group, it seems deeper.
Yeah.
It's, it's a collective consciousness, but it adds to share it with people, so.
Oh, it sure does. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Oh, my goodness, Mom. Thank you for having me, and look forward to next Saturday.
I look forward to seeing you.
Yeah, and enjoy the journey during the week, guys.
Thanks, Michael.
All right. Thank you so much. Be well.
Yeah, you too.
Take care. Laura, good to see you this morning.
Good to be here. Everyone said everything that I've thought of. And share those experiences as well. I find these teachings are, so pure and true and resonate. And I can just kind of let it seep in and I'm very content with that. And meditation has been, just this sense of freedom to have that space that we have here, and when you sit at home, that that's free from the distractions of the world, other than whatever not self conditioned thinking is arising and bubbling up in your mind. But I think at this point in my practice, I recognize all of that is not self, and it can be, depending on my state of mind, can really be just like, a river passing by. And I feel like I've let my life and outside of meditation I've allowed myself to be okay with being where I am instead of bringing this not-self into it and trying to be somewhere I'm not so much, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Like
bringing this ego or bringing anatta into what I do. And so it feels like the integration's on another level or something, because I'm a little more relaxed, with my imperfections, I guess, my day-to-day, and, allowing my not mindfulness states to just be there without beating myself up about it.
Yeah.
And then when I am brought back to my, awareness, really through meditation practice, it's naturally going to be more and more outside of meditation. The mindfulness will naturally integrate more and more. So I feel like I've just relaxed a little bit, and that's been really humbling and really useful in the broader sense of the Eightfold Path. And in some ways, it's really, there's less clinging. I'm clinging less to some mind state that I'm hoping for in each moment, and clinging less to, trying to react in the best way to to what my children are doing or someone else is doing, there's been a shift, I would say, and it just will, on the journey, will naturally progress. So anyhow, I'm glad to be back today. I hope to be coming more regularly on Saturdays, because I do miss coming to Sangha, but I haven't been so anxious about not coming, I guess, this past month, because I really, it was not the middle way to force it. I was called to be with my family, I was called to be with my kids, it had to be that way, so. It was like a 2-month break or something. Anyway.
Well, we missed you. I'm so glad you made it today. And you're so right to not, anytime you judge yourself harshly, even if it's, I should be doing more meditation or I should be going to Sangha more. Those are things that are hurtful. They're not helpful. It's enough to recognize the benefits of practice, the benefits of coming here, but never to judge ourselves harshly for anything. You know, it's a surefire way of feeding the ego, you know, and keeping that anatta, the five clinging aggregates, well fed by judging yourself harshly. So thank you for saying that and for practicing it. And I hope to see you next week. Yeah. Eva, good to see you.
Tom, sorry, I need
the help. Hold on, Eva. I'd love to give you a chance to say something if you have anything to say.
It's nice to be back here.
It's good to see you.
Found the half hour thing kind of a challenge because I've been doing shorter meditation, so that was kind of nice change there.
Yeah, good.
I'm sorry to light out.
That's okay. Yeah. We've gone a little bit longer today, so it's good to see you, John.
Yeah, you too. Hope to see you again soon.
Before I get to Eva, does anybody else have to leave? We've probably got another 10 minutes or so to finish. Eva, it's good to see you. Take care, Joe.
Thanks,
like Michael said, I enjoy meditation, but there's definitely a difference when I meditate with a group. It seems richer. I don't know, I do get a... physical,
yeah.
Environmental sensation. And that's wonderful. Thank you for having this for us. And I have always had a confusion with the four frames of foundations of meditation.
Yep, they're sometimes called the four frames of reference, too.
So okay, and the... clinging aggregates, because the clinging aggregates, if I'm not mistaken, or the five hindrances. Five hindrances, I think.
Yeah.
Are those there's the form and there's the perceptions?
Oh, that's the five clinging aggregates.
Okay, those are the five clinging.
Form, feeling, right. Perceptions,
so
mental fabrication.
They get me confused because in one way you're saying they're hindrances and then here they're almost the same thing, but now they're... foundation for meditation.
Here we go. There's five clinging aggregates, and
I understand it. No,
and that. There's five hindrances.
Right.
They're two different teachings.
Okay.
So
it's the five clinging aggregates and the four foundations of meditation that confuse
yes.
me because they're the same terms. You're talking about your thoughts. You're talking about your minds, but in one they're hindrances, and in the other ones they're the foundation. So
yep.
I would get confused, but because of your classes. And the way you're explaining it, I understand that they are, that's why they're their foundation, because they're the problem.
Boy, exactly. Yeah, and that's so important to understand that. The word is there, the feeling is part of both descriptions, but one is what we use in meditation that relates to the self, the five clinging aggregates, or the personal experience of suffering is a better way to say it than the self. And there's that connection there. And it's so important that you see that, but also it's so important that you brought it up here, because that could, if it's confusing for you, it's probably confusing for a lot of us. I think I did. I always tried to apply the five clinging aggregates as a teaching to understand in a conceptual way rather than a description of what was happening to me. And when I finally got that, it really changed everything. Because now I understood that I am the personal experience of suffering. It's because of my own ignorance. It's not because of anything else. It's because I'm lacking a certain understanding that I'm having whatever difficulties I'm having in the world. So it's important to understand that. Thank you.
That, what she just said, just made a connection that I wanted to share. That the five clinging aggregates... are clinging, but if you put your mindfulness on them, they begin to unravel, and then they're just aggregates.
Just
and
aggregates.
Now you just see them, and the four foundations of mindfulness teaching allows you to see the aggregates separately.
Yes.
And not together.
Yes, that's exactly how and why the Buddha taught five clinging aggregates. When we are awakened, unbound, we are still engage with the aggregates, but they're no longer clinging together to define a self. They're simply all aspects of impermanence. Form is impermanent. Feelings are impermanent. Perceptions are impermanent. The perception that I'm having in this moment that, oh, I'm not doing enough Dhamma practice is impermanent. Let it go. And if you don't, it leads to a formation, an assumption. And if you do let it go, it doesn't. And the five clinging aggregates, I'm going to say they fall apart. They're just no longer clinging together. Another way of saying that is when you can do that, you're also unraveling the links of dependent origination. There's no longer ignorance giving rise to suffering in that direct way. So thank you both. Great understanding. So, and it really shows the importance of the Sangha. You know? It's not something that I said. It arose from you. So thank you all. Mary, good to see you this morning. How are you?
You're good. Today's talk was excellent, and it's so easy to fall off of the horse here, which I've been all week, and instead of feeling something and knowing that it's going to pass, I want to fight it, and that just makes it worse.
Yeah.
And so this was a good reminder.
Yeah, what a great understanding that it just makes it worse. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And it's a great metaphor. Mary's an equestrian, so falling off the horse. Thank you. Lorna, good to see you this morning.
Thank you. Good to be here. I had, just when you were talking, just so many aha moments, that you sort of piece it all together and you get clarity. So this teaching is give me a clearer understanding, should I say, which is good. I'm a bit woolly about when you are at peace with the less than peaceful mind, or I don't know if it's I'm just beginning to accept whatever's been bothering me, which is outside the Dharma practice. I would have done it anyway, whether I came here or not. If something comes up in life and it irritates your mind, you can't hang on to it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually it goes, whether you come to Dhamma or not. You can just begin to accept it. And I'm not sure if I'm accepting things that arise in my life. I'm just learning to accept them earlier, so I'm having less aggravation in my mind, or as I say, I'm not really feels a little bit woolly in my mind. I'm not really sure what's going on.
Well, first thing, I love that term, bully.
You're saying bully or woolly?
Woolly.
Yeah. A little fuzzy. That's the nature of the process of awakening. You're first recognizing. It doesn't really matter where in that process that you are, but it does matter that you're recognizing that the process is ongoing, that you're developing a deeper understanding of the qualities of your mind. Again, four foundations of mindfulness. So if you're simply reacting less to what you're holding in mind, that's enough.
Yeah.
It really is, because again, it's the process. Not many people awaken like Kandana did, nearly instantly. Most of us engage in the Dhamma practice and it takes some time. Ananda awakened after listening to the Buddha for 45 years plus a month after the Buddha died, he awakened. And none of that matters. The time frame doesn't matter, except to understand that it is in this lifetime that we can awaken. And that's the most important thing. Because with recognizing the opportunity to awaken is in this lifetime, we will likely take to the Dhamma with as much kshanti, patient forbearance, but right effort that we can. We do the best we can, that's all. Understanding that it's possible to actually do this, that's taking true refuge. A human being did this, and he taught us how to do it. And we are so incredibly fortunate, you hear me say this, to have a Sangha that is this well-focused and actually developing it, to share things like that. So thank you. Debbie, good morning. Good to see you. Thank you for bringing your sister.
I guess that was relating a lot to what Stephan said.
Excuse me.
The thoughts getting the grip. I feel like sometimes it's like a vice,
Yeah.
It's like I'm so struggling to get rid of those thoughts. But then I try to be gentle with myself and say, well, at least I'm beginning to be aware. Maybe I'm not loosening the vice as much as I want to, but, you know, simply things like the weather, you know, like the weather is going to be, when my sister was flying in, I had so much angst about it was the day of the big thunderstorm and the drama the weather had around it. It was like, you know, whether she, you know, would be safe, whether she would land, getting hung up in worry and anxiety about that, you know, but also having awareness that I was doing that and trying to breathe through it and come back to my breath, and yet still feeling that I kept getting pulled back in, you know, creates anxiety and feeling that in my body, coming back, trying to breathe, you know, it's really a growth process that it's really a struggle a lot of, you know, when you talk about the struggle, you know, that deluded thinking stuff, that's so real for me, and what Michael said about 90% of the time, I feel like I'm still hooked into that struggle, you know, but, and the insight's coming, and, you know, even if it's here and there, the little bits of breathing, coming into peace, you know, it's a process.
Yeah, you are, thank you, that 1% is enough. You know, it's enough. It's enough to get started. It seems like a pretty narrow door at times, but it's wide open. And you are taking true refuge. And when you recognize it, you're caught up, and you recognize that, and you come back to what you've learned. That's what it means to take refuge. You're taking refuge in the Dhamma, and you understand it. It's so important, and it's having in the desired effect, I would say. So, thank you. Nora, welcome to our Sangha. How was your meditation?
It was very good. It was very rejuvenating.
Ah, good.
Helped me to rejuvenate my practice.
I hope so. You were able to maintain the method. You recognized you were caught up in your thoughts, came back to your breath. That's the basic meditation practice. And then as you see, it's part of a broader framework called the Eightfold Path. But that's what we teach here. And there's a lot of information on my website. And talks from 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years now that you can listen to if you want. So I hope you do. I hope you can join us online. These talks are on YouTube and they're recorded too on my podcast. So,
well, thanks for the welcome.
Yeah. Well, anytime you're here, you know, please feel welcome. Do you have any questions about what we talked about?
No, I don't think so.
And there's a recording of this meditation on the website that you can download and help it guide your practice. And there's also instructions on that same page. So yeah, glad you're here.
Thank you.
Thank you all. So let's, no other questions? Let's finish with metta as we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture. And gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that have arisen from our talk today. And metta means goodwill or loving kindness, and it's both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an ongoing expression of an awakened, fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.